Welcome to the reading of the Sioux City Journal for Tuesday, August 17th. I'm your reader, Dagna, and we'll begin today with the mini editorial on the front page. And today's mini editorial is written by Kevin Brazier of Paulina, Iowa. And Kevin writes, "With the huge success of MLB's Field of Dreams game last week, why not play the Iowa High School Boys State Baseball Tournament there? Wow, what a great facility to host our Boys Summer Classic." Again, this was written by Kevin Brazier of Paulina, Iowa. Our first story is headlined, "Siouxland Afghanistan Veterans React to Taliban Takeover." And this story was written by Dolly Butts of the Sioux City Journal. Holstein, Iowa. On a chaotic June morning in 2011, Staff Sergeant Peter Madsen took a bullet in the right shoulder while engaged in a shootout in Afghanistan. As gunfire peppered the area, Madsen hopped from his truck and continued leading soldiers. 40 U.S. troops battled under Madsen's command this mission, one conducted in Paktia Province. The firefight lasted for hours. The Iowa Army National Guard later honored the Holstein man for heroism, presenting him with the Bronze Star with a V for Valor, the top honor bestowed upon any of the soldiers who served in Afghanistan that year, and a Purple Heart. As the Taliban swept into Kabul on Sunday, bringing an end to a two-decade campaign in which the United States and its allies had tried to transform Afghanistan, Madsen reflected on his tour of duty in the country, the first time from 2004 to 2005, and the second from 2010 to 2011. "The first time I made some really good friends, Afghanis, and we got out to see the people. Now to hear of a lot of that is getting destroyed is kind of upsetting," Madsen, 48, said on Monday. "It looks to be diminishing all the hard work we put in both times we went in." Across the country, there were a range of opinions expressed by Americans who served in Afghanistan about the Taliban's rapid takeover after U.S. troops were withdrawn. With the capital city gripped with panic, the U.S. struggled to evacuate its citizens and Afghani allies from the Kabul airport. Ford Fairchild, who spent a little over a year representing the U.S. Justice Department in Afghanistan, said on Monday he is not surprised by the dire situation in the country, but is also nonetheless horrified. "This is just an unyielding social tragedy. The people of Afghanistan, particularly our partners in Afghanistan, are facing a reversion of their rights and liberties that is just almost unfathomable. It's just heartbreaking," said Fairchild, a Terrell, Iowa native who's been an assistant U.S. attorney in Sioux City since 2004. Fairchild served as a special deputy marshal and the justice attaché, the U.S. Attorney General's representative in Afghanistan from 2016 to 2017. He said his job was to work active investigations for prosecution in the United States, as well as advise and mentor high-level investigations of narcotics, terrorism, and other cases involving national security. "The collapse of the Afghani government and the Taliban seizing control was predicted," said Fairchild, who noted it was a risk that every policymaker was aware of. "I can't believe how this had been allowed to happen, and I don't know how you would have stopped it," he said. Fairchild said he worries about the situation. "He worries that the situation emboldens our enemies across the world and undermines our allies' belief in our ability to commit to difficult problems. There were many problems with the way we litigated our effort overseas, and one of those was that we haven't really been in Afghanistan for 20 years. We have been there 20 times for a year each time. That made a difficult problem even more difficult to address, I think," he said. Sioux City Mayor says he's ready for fireworks ban to come up for council vote. This also was written by Dolly Butts. Sioux City. Sioux City Mayor Bob Scott indicated Monday that he's prepared to vote on a fireworks ban. "I'm ready to vote. I'm waiting for the council to make sure they're ready to vote," Scott said during the council comments portion of the meeting in response to Councilman Pete Gretkin asking, "What happens now with the fireworks?" Scott did not say whether he will vote for or against an all-out ban on fireworks within the city limits. Moments before that exchange, residents Mark Solheim and Randy Giles requested that the council adopt a total ban on fireworks. Both Solheim and Giles have previously implored the council to restore peace in Sioux City's neighborhoods. There will always be those who do not follow the law. However, law-abiding citizens will, and that will cut down on some of the terror, Giles said. Last January, in response to the complaints of pet owners, veterans, and others, the council passed ordinance changes that added a municipal infraction penalty for property owners who permit firework violations to occur on their property. Mayor Pro Tem Dan Moore also led a PSA campaign ahead of the most recent holiday to encourage residents to adhere to the city fireworks ordinance, which allows discharges only from 1 to 11 p.m. on July 3rd and 4th and from 1 p.m. on December 31st until 12:30 a.m. on January 1st. Both Giles and Solheim have said those efforts did not do enough to curb illegal discharges. Giles said Sioux City Fire Marshal Mark Aesop and retired Sioux City Fire Marshal Chuck Hirsch support a fireworks ban. Giles said she has spoken with fire officials in Dubuque, Cedar Rapids, Iowa City, Des Moines, and Spencer about what they do to protect their citizens. They said they all don't regret setting ordinances to prohibit the use of fireworks. I've talked to VA centers across the state. I've talked to fire marshals across the state. They all want to see fireworks banned in the state, Solheim said. Our own fire marshal, Mark Aesop, said we need to ban fireworks. His predecessor, Chuck Hirsch, says fireworks should be banned. I don't understand how we can appoint someone to this position of authority and responsibility to oversee the safety of our community and then not pay attention to what they have to say. Gretkin, a retired Sioux City police captain, said during a July 12th council meeting that he would not be opposed to voting for a ban. Councilman Alex Waters described the fireworks issue Monday as a really challenging topic. It's something that I try giving a lot of thought about and weighing pros and cons and trying to understand both sides, he said. I hear your concerns. Sioux City man faces murder trial for fatal stabbing. Police and prosecutors allege that Michael Landrum fatally stabbing another man after getting into an argument about a missing cell phone. Landrum's attorney says the Sioux City man acted in self-defense and necessity. A jury of 12 Woodbury County residents soon will decide if Landrum is guilty or not guilty of fatally stabbing Salahan Adam and seriously injuring Natasha Drapeau. Jury selection begins Tuesday in Woodbury County District Court, and the trial is expected to last through the week and into next week. District Judge Stephen Andreessen will preside. Landrum, 55, has pleaded not guilty of first-degree murder, attempted murder, and willful injury causing serious injury. He is charged with stabbing Adam, 37, on September 11th in an apartment building at 2103 Nebraska Street. He is also accused of stabbing Drapeau, 43, who was hospitalized with serious injuries. According to court documents, Landrum, who lived nearby, was at a party with the victims and then left. He returned shortly looking for his cell phone. The victims helped him look for it, and Landrum began accusing them of taking it, became upset, and left. He returned at about 12:55 a.m., pounded on the door, and when Drapeau answered it, Landrum stabbed her multiple times with a steak-style knife. When Adam came to her assistance, Landrum stabbed him multiple times, court documents said. Police found Landrum walking in the 2400 block of Nebraska Street about 90 minutes later and arrested him without incident. Public defender Billy Oradair has filed notices that he will argue defenses of self-defense, defense of property, necessity, compulsion, and resisting a forcible felony. If found guilty of first-degree murder, Landrum would face a mandatory sentence of life in prison without parole. Attempted murder carries a prison sentence of 25 years, and willful injury is punishable by a 10-year prison sentence. Siouxland man sought by Fugitive Task Force. The U.S. Marshal Service Northern Iowa Fugitive Task Force is seeking the public's assistance in locating the following person. Philippe Alcaraz, 31. Is 6 foot tall and weighs 205 pounds. Alcaraz is wanted on a warrant issued in Woodbury County for parole for a felony drug conviction. Anyone with information can contact the U.S. Marshal Service at 712-252-0211 or email siouxlands.mostwanted@usdoj.gov. Evans to perform Orpheum Christmas Concert, Sioux City. Multi-platinum entertainer Sarah Evans will be bringing her Christmas show to the Orpheum Theater at 528 Pier Street on December 16th. As the fifth most played female artist in country radio for nearly 20 years, Evans is best known for such number one singles as No Place That Far, Suds in the Bucket, A Real Fine Place to Start, Born to Fly, and A Little Bit Stronger. Evans will be joined by special guest Everett at this show. Tickets will go on sale at 10 a.m. Friday at Tyson Events Center, Prime Bank Box Office, by phone at 712-279-4850 or at orpheum-live.com. We now have some pictures that were from the Riverside Pool Pooch Paddle. And one picture is Kia, an 8-month-old Pomeranian Husky mix, plays in the water Monday during Pooch Paddle at the Sioux City's Riverside Aquatic Center. A Pooch Paddle for large breed dogs will be held at the pool tomorrow. The event is held annually after the city pools close to human bathers. We also have a picture of Bailey Nichols, 6 years old, leans in to kiss Peanut, a Yorkie Chihuahua mix, Monday during the Pooch Paddle. And then we have Scout, a Puggle, fetches a ball as Kia, a Pomeranian Husky mix, leaps in the air Monday during the Pooch Paddle. We'll now have a couple of COVID-related stories, and the first one is, will you need a vaccine passport? What to know as more places require proof of COVID-19 shots. Ready to go out on the town before summer ends? In parts of the United States, you might have to carry your COVID-19 vaccine card or a digital copy to get into restaurants, bars, nightclubs, and outdoor music festivals. After resisting the divisive concept of vaccine passports through most of the pandemic, a fast-growing number of private venues and some local officials are now requiring proof of immunization in public settings to reduce the spread of the highly transmissible Delta variant of the coronavirus. It's unlikely the U.S. will adopt a national mandate like the one in France, which began on August 16th, requiring people to show a QR code proving that they have a special virus pass before they can enjoy restaurants and cafes or travel across the country. But enough venues are starting to ask for digital passes to worry some privacy advocates who fear the trend could habituate consumers to constant tracking. Who's asking for the vaccine passports? New York City set the tone earlier this month when Mayor Bill de Blasio announced that the city will soon require proof of COVID-19 vaccination for anyone who wants to dine indoors at a restaurant, see a performance, or go to a gym. San Francisco announced an even more stringent requirement August 12th for proof of full vaccination for all customers and staff at a number of indoor activities. A growing number of private venues, from Broadway theaters to music clubs in Minneapolis and Milwaukee, have also established their own similar rules for patrons. I'm a firm believer in the right for people to choose whether or not they get the vaccine, said Tammy Montgomery, owner of Drew's Bar in Memphis, which has started asking for paper vaccine cards along with photo identification. But it's my business, and I have to make decisions based on what will protect my staff, business, and customers. Only in a handful of states, Texas and Florida are the biggest, are private businesses prohibited from requiring proof of vaccination. How do they work? In some places, venues are simply asking you to bring your vaccination card, the same piece of paper you get from health providers and the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. Take a picture of that card at home and then showing the image to the bouncer at the club can also work. New York City offers a streamlined way of showing a photo through its New York City COVID Safe app, in which people can store images of their vaccine cards and then display them in the app when needed. Other places are encouraging people to register their credentials using a scannable digital pass, like New York statewide Excelsior Pass, or a similar system adopted by California, Hawaii, and Louisiana, and private companies like Walmart and the airport security app Clear. Such passes are designed for convenience and to prevent fraud, but that's also where the biggest privacy concern emerges, said Adam Schwartz, senior staff attorney at the Electronic Frontier Foundation. What's wrong with QR codes? The barcode known as a QR code was originally designed to help track products in a factory. These days, it's increasingly being used to track people's devices. Those systems are a giant leap towards tracking people's location, Schwartz said. There's a very real risk of mission creep once there are scanners at doors and people are showing their scannable token to pass through. But the coalition that helped create the smart health card framework used by New York, California, and the Canadian province of Quebec say they've already set privacy safeguards to guard against misuse of health data. So long as a venue is using a VCI-compliant scanner, there should not be anything to worry about, said Dr. Brian Anderson, chief digital health physician at MITRE and co-lead of the Vaccination Credential Initiative, which counts Apple, Microsoft, and the Mayo Clinic among its members. That app won't store an individual's data beyond the time that the QR code is scanned. Well, why not stick with paper? Proponents of digital passports say they're more convenient for already overwhelmed restaurants and other venues because workers don't have to peer at everyone's vaccine cards before letting them in. Lines move faster, and the digital scan reassures those who don't want to risk damaging or losing their paper cards. It's also easy to fake a paper card or a photo of one. The startup CrowdPass, which generates QR codes so vaccinated people can attend events, said it helped get about 15,000 people swiftly admitted into the recent Newport Folk and Newport Jazz Festivals in Rhode Island. The events required all attendees to digitally upload proof of vaccination or a recent negative test. Demand was slow at first, said Duncan Abenor, the startup's co-founder and president. But since the Delta variant has sprung, we've had a huge uptick. Among its clients are couples planning weddings and organizers of other small events. Abenor said the biggest spike in calls came after New York City's announcement. It's a crowded market that includes apps made by Clear and Walmart, many of which have now signed onto the VCI's privacy standards and code for conduct. But for Schwartz of the EFF, the best advice for venues that need to see proof of vaccination is to stick to asking for the CDC card or a photo of it. The process of making vaccination checks should end when the pandemic does, Schwartz said. Some of the companies that are in this space have a track record of being in the business of monetizing data, he added. I'm not going to name names, but they're the last people that should be involved in the developing scanners for proof of vaccination. Then our next story is headlined, Virus Misinformation Spreads at Public Forums. There are plenty of places to turn for accurate information about COVID-19. Your physician, the local health department, the U.S. Centers for Disease Control, but not perhaps your local government's public comment session. During a meeting of the St. Louis County Council earlier this month, opponents of a possible mask mandate made so many misleading comments about masks, vaccines, and COVID-19 that YouTube removed the video for violating its policies against false claims about the virus. I hope no one is making any medical decisions based on what they hear at our public forums, said County Councilwoman Lisa Clancy, who supports mask wearing and said she believes most of her constituents do too. The video was restored, but Clancy's worries about the impact of that misinformation remain. Videos of local government meetings have emerged as the latest vector of COVID-19 misinformation, broadcasting misleading claims about masks and vaccines to millions, and creating new challenges for internet platforms trying to balance the potential harm against the need for government openness. The latest video to go viral features a local physician who made several misleading claims about COVID-19. While addressing the Mount Vernon Community School Corporation in Fortville, Indiana on August 6. In his 6-minute remarks, Dr. Dan Stock tells the board that masks don't work, vaccines don't prevent infection, and the state and federal health officials don't follow the science. The video has amassed tens of millions of online views and prompted the Indiana State Department of Health to push back. Stock did not return multiple messages seeking comment. Here comes a doctor in suspenders who goes in front of the school board and basically says what some people are thinking, that masks are BS, vaccines don't work, and the CDC is lying. It can be very compelling to lay people, said Dr. Zubin Damania, a California physician who received so many messages about the Indiana clip that he created his own video debunking Stock's claims. Domania hosts a popular online medical show under the name ZDogMD. His video debunking stocks comments have been viewed more than 400,000 times so far. He said, while there are legitimate questions about the effectiveness of mask requirements for children, Stock's broad criticism of masks and vaccines went too far. YouTube removed several similar videos of local government meetings in North Carolina, Missouri, Kansas, and Washington State. In Bellingham, Washington, officials responded by temporarily suspending public comment sessions. The false claims in those videos were made during the portion of the meeting devoted to public comment. Local officials have no control over what is said at these forums and say that's part of the problem. In Kansas, YouTube pulled video of the May school board meeting in the 27,000 student Shawnee Mission District, in which parents and a state lawmaker called for the district to remove its mask mandate, citing medical misinformation. The district, where a mask mandate remains in effect, responded by ending live streaming of the public comment period. District spokesman David Smith acknowledged that it has been challenging to balance making the board meetings accessible and not spreading fallacies. It was hard for me to hear things in the board meeting that weren't true and to know that those were going out without contradiction, Smith said. I am all about free speech, but when that free speech endangers people's lives, it is hard to sit through that. After hearing from local officials, YouTube reversed its decision and put the videos back up. Earlier this month, the company, which is owned by Google, announced a change to its COVID misinformation policy to allow exceptions for local government meetings, though YouTube may still remove content that uses remarks from public forums in an attempt to mislead. While we have clear policies to remove harmful COVID-19 misinformation, we also recognize the importance of organizations like school districts and city councils using YouTube to share recordings of open public forums, even when comments at those forums may violate our policies, company spokeswoman Elena Hernandez said. The deluge of false claims about the virus also challenged other platforms, too. Twitter and Facebook each have their own policies on COVID-19 misinformation and say that, like YouTube, they attach labels to misleading content and remove the worst of it. Public comment sessions preceding local government meetings have long been known for sometimes colorful remarks from local residents. But before the internet, if someone were to drone on about fluoride in the drinking water, for instance, their comments were not likely to become national news. Now, thanks to the internet and social media, the misleading musings of a local doctor speaking before a school board can compete for attention with the recommendations of the CDC. It was only a matter of time before misleading comments at these local public forums went viral, according to Jennifer Greigel, a communications professor at Syracuse University who studies social media platforms. And we now have another story concerning COVID, and this one is titled, Travelers Face Issues Amid Delta Variant's Rise. The travel landscape has changed dramatically in just a few short weeks. The United States is on its fourth COVID-19 surge thanks to the highly contagious Delta variant, with cases bouncing back to levels not seen since February. Other countries are also reporting more COVID-19 cases. That leaves travelers, many of whom booked trips months ago when case counts were low, wondering whether or not to follow through with their plans. The Delta variant is a different beast, Richard Webby, who helps lead St. Jude's Children's Research Hospital's Infectious Disease Department, told us. This virus is everywhere. As far as whether or not it's safe to travel, it depends on what you're trying to do. Health experts say travel risks vary from person to person, but it may be time for certain travelers, especially those who are unvaccinated or susceptible to severe illnesses from the virus, to postpone their trips. If you're vaccinated and fully immunized against this virus, then it poses a slight increased risk to you, Webby said. But among the unvaccinated population, this virus is going to cause more cases. It's going to spread more easily and more rapidly. If you are not vaccinated, now is not a good time to travel. The U.S. reported 131,917 new cases on Wednesday, surpassing levels not seen since February, according to Centers for Disease Control and Prevention data. Over 90% of counties in the United States are experiencing high or substantial transmission, and the CDC suggests both vaccinated and unvaccinated travelers avoid travel to more than 70 countries due to high COVID-19 case counts. The Delta variant is around twice as transmissible as the variant that caused such a horrific period in our history in December and January, said John Swartzberg, a professor at the University of California, Berkeley School of Public Health. It's going to be a lot easier for you to get infected this time than it was last during the last surge of cases. Dr. Purvu Parikh, an immunologist who has worked as an investigator for some of the COVID-19 vaccine trials, advises vaccines for travelers since the majority of the recent COVID-19 deaths and hospitalizations are among non-vaccinated people. She also suggests checking local guidance and infection rates before booking a flight. You may want to defer travel if an area is having a spike or surge, she said. Be adaptable because much of this is dynamic and changing. Is it safe to travel during the Delta surge? Rachel Pilch-Loeb, a researcher at Harvard School of Public Health, says there's no one-size-fits-all piece of advice for travelers debating whether or not to postpone their trips. The level of risk depends on travelers' vaccination status, whether they have an increased risk for severe illness, and what the infection rate is like at their destination. She added that breakthrough cases remain rare, but should be taken into consideration by vaccinated travelers. A small percentage of people who are fully vaccinated will still get COVID-19 if exposed to the virus that causes it, but is much less likely to get severely sick or die. I would think about my own risk tolerance, meaning, am I okay if I get a little bit sick? Pilch-Loeb said. If you are uncomfortable with the potential that you may be infected, then your decision-making may be a little bit different. The capacity of the destination's healthcare system should also be considered, now that certain hospitals are running out of available ICU beds. Pilch-Loeb recommends getting tested ahead of travel, regardless of destination or vaccination status, and opting for safer forms of travel such as driving. She also suggests people go back to key virus mitigation strategies such as mask wearing, social distancing, and avoiding time indoors with people whose vaccination status is unclear. Travel restrictions vary across countries. Some are continuing to ease roadblocks to entry. Both Canada and the United Kingdom lifted travel restrictions against American travelers in recent weeks, while others are starting to introduce new safety protocols or reimpose restrictions that have been pushed aside ahead of the busy summer travel season. Puerto Rico will require all hotel and short-term rental guests to show proof of a COVID-19 vaccination or submit a weekly negative coronavirus test starting on Monday. And both France and Italy require proof of vaccination to enter restaurants and other venues. If I was a country that didn't have a lot of this Delta variant activity going on, it's a virus that I'd want to keep out of my community, Webby said. I would certainly be imposing travel restrictions from places where this virus is rampant. Unfortunately, at the moment, that's a lot of places around the globe. Parikh believes the variant will definitely impact the international travel. Various parts of the world may go back on lockdown depending on spread, and vaccines and testing will be required, she said via email. Some countries may have to reinforce lockdown, travel bans, masking, and quarantines, depending on how bad it is. She added that the easing of restrictions will depend on countries' vaccination efforts, and many are behind. Popular tourist destinations in the United States are starting to reimpose COVID-19 restrictions as well. Mask mandates are resurfacing in destinations across the United States, like Las Vegas and Los Angeles, and Hawaii has cut its restaurant and bar capacity down to 50%. Other cities, like San Francisco and New Orleans, now require proof of vaccination for indoor events. The CDC cautions Americans to make sure they are fully vaccinated before traveling, and recommends all travelers, regardless of vaccination status, wear masks and self-monitor for COVID-19 symptoms. If traveling internationally, fully vaccinated travelers should also get tested 3 to 5 days after travel. Unvaccinated people traveling both domestically and internationally are advised to get tested 1 to 3 days before and 3 to 5 days after travel and self-quarantine 7 days after returning. You are listening to the reading of the Sioux City Journal for Tuesday, August 17th on IRIS, the Iowa Radio Reading Information Service for the Blind. We'll now turn to today's obituaries. Lauren Brookfield from Paulina, Iowa, 76, died Friday, August 13th. Services will be August 18th at 10:30 a.m. at the First Presbyterian Church in Paulina. Burial will be at the Prairie View Cemetery in Paulina with military honors. Visitation will be today, August 17th, from 5 to 7 p.m. at the Eldridge Family Funeral Home in Paulina. Virginia E. Phipps, Cherokee, Iowa, 91, died Saturday, August 14th. Services will be August 20th at 11 a.m. at Greenwood Shrewbert Funeral Home in Cherokee. Burial will be at the Mount Calvary Cemetery in Cherokee. Visitation will be August 19th from 5 to 7 p.m. at the funeral home. Elizabeth Figueroa, Emerson, Nebraska, 28, died Sunday, August 15th. Services will be August 18th at 10:30 a.m. at the Sacred Heart Catholic Church in Emerson. Visitation will be August 17th, today, from 5 to 7 p.m. at the church. Arrangements are with the Munderloaf Smith Funeral Home in Emerson. And that concludes the obituaries for today. We'll now move to the sports section, and our first story is about the Explorers. And the headline is, Explorers pull off stunner with 5-run ninth. Sioux City. Trailing 9-5 and down to their final out, the Sioux City Explorers rallied for 5 runs on Sunday to beat Claiborne 10-9 and take the rubber game of the weekend series. The ninth inning comeback wasn't the only deficit Sioux City had to rally from, as Claiborne posted their own 2-out rally in the third. A Chase Simpson base hit gave Claiborne an early 1-0 lead. John Nestor then hit the Railroaders' first grand slam of the season to make it 5-0, and Tyler Ryan crushed a 2-run homer to put Claiborne up 7-0. Sioux City immediately cut into the deficit in the bottom of the third when Lane Milligan hit a 2-run shot, his 10th homer of the season, to make it 7-2. The X's added another run in the fourth, while a bases-loaded walk from Jose Sermo to make it 7-3. Claiborne added a pair in the sixth on Ramon Hernandez and DJ Peterson base hits, pushing their advantage to 9-3. The X's once again were able to immediately answer in the bottom half of the inning, with George Khalil scoring on a Sermo sacrifice fly to right field. Seamus Curran opened up the bottom of the seventh with a solo home run to make it a 9-5 game. In the ninth inning, DJ Poteet pinch hit for Khalil with 2 outs and 2 on and smacked a 2nd homer of the season. The 3-run shot cut the deficit to 1 run. Blake Timberary then went back-to-back with Poteet as he slammed one over the right field wall, tying the game at 9-9. After a Lang single and a Sermo walk, it was Lane Milligan who was the hero, hitting a flare up the middle of the infield that hit 2nd base and bounced into center, allowing Lang to score and the X's finishing off the 5-run ninth inning comeback. In all 3 games of the series, the winning team took the lead in their final at-bat. With the win, Sioux City now moves just 1 game behind Claiborne for the 3rd-place postseason spot in the South Division, with the series coming up with the Railroaders next weekend in Claiborne. The Explorers hit the road for the start of a 3-game series in Kansas City on Tuesday. We'll now move to a golf story. Douglas rallies to win Men's City Championship. Contrary to what was reported in Sunday's edition of the Journal, Johnny Douglas will be a member of the Morningside University golf team this season. In fact, Douglas, a native of England, celebrated his return to the United States with a victory in the 108th Rick Collins Toyota Men's City Championship Sunday at Green Valley. Douglas shot even par for 45 holes over the weekend, coming from behind on the final 9 holes to surpass teammate Zan Milligan for the title. The 22-year-old from Newcastle upon Tyne, England, had twice previously finished runner-up in this event. He arrived in Sioux City on Thursday and had little time to prepare for Saturday's opening round. Nonetheless, Douglas shot 1-under-71 but still trailed Milligan from Hexham, England, by 3 shots. Milligan followed his first round 68 with a 75 on the first 18 holes Sunday. Douglas, meanwhile, carded 74 and trailed Milligan by 2 shots heading into the final 9 holes. "This means a lot to me," Douglas said. "This is probably the 4th time I've played in it, and Sioux City has become sort of a second home. I played in the City Championship 2 days after I got here my first year. I watched Corey obliterate the field then, so I knew it was going to be nice to win this one." Douglas shot 35 over his final 9 holes, while Milligan slipped to a 40. Sam Story, another Morningside Linkster, also caught Milligan with 38, finishing in a tie for second place. Douglas, who totaled 180, Milligan and Story will be stalemates for first-year coach Nick Walderscheid at Morningside this fall. Milligan and Story finished at 183 with Josh Wendling 184 and Ryan Kinseth 186 rounded out the top 5. Douglas began his final 9 with par, then made birdie on number 2 before giving it right back with a bogey on number 3, but had to work hard even to make a 5. A birdie on the par 5-6 drew Douglas even with Milligan. Each player bogeyed on the par 3-7th. Milligan, after hitting his tee shot in the water left of the green. Misfortune struck Milligan on number 8 when he wound up making double bogey, and Douglas took advantage of a nifty chip off the green to par. He cemented his victory with a par on number 9. "I didn't do anything spectacular, but got it done in the end," Douglas said. "I think I played considerably better score-wise in my two second-place finishes than today. Obviously, the field didn't play that great this week, so a total finish of level par was good enough to win." 9 players made the cut for the final 9, with a cutoff at 149. The win by Douglas makes it 3 in a row for Morningside golfers. Corey Matthey, who went on to win the NAIA National Individual Championship last spring, won each of the last 2 city crowns. Matthey departed for Arizona and a shot at professional golf shortly after winning the Rivercade last month. The lowest round in the open division on Sunday belonged to second flight winner Tony Ginger, who shaved 3 strokes off par with 69. Sam Prue coasted to victory in the senior division, shooting 71-72 in the 36-hole competition. Scott Knowles was second, but a full 9 shots back in NF 152. It's been a great season for the 61-year-old Prue, who won the Interstate Amateur in a playoff in June and is the leader in the Player of the Year point standing. This was the final major tournament of the season. The Lamar's Labor Day Open is the final points events for the regular season, leading up to the traditional finale, the Dividen Cup, set for September 25th, 26th at Dakota Dunes Country Club. We'll now move to a football story, high school football, and the headline is, "We're going to shock some people. West football ready to prove doubters wrong." Head coach Brandon Holmes and the Sioux City West football team are ready to surprise Northwest Iowa football fans in 2021. The past few years have been challenging for the Wolverines, to say the least. The team has gone winless in each of the past 2 seasons and currently holds a 25-game losing streak, a skid which dates back to September 7, 2018. But this year, the Wolverines' second-year head coach is confident the program can fight its way to respectability and maybe even score the team's first winning season since 2006. While even a single win would spell an improvement over the last 2 years, Holmes wants more. "As a coach, you never want to limit yourself to 1 or 2 wins. You always think that you have a chance at winning all of them. This year, with the seniors that we have come back and the additions that we do have, I am very optimistic that we can definitely get a few of those in the win column this year." According to Holmes, it all starts on the line for the Wolverines. Last season, the Wolverines went into the year with only 1 senior lineman in Travis Rivera. Now, with a year of experience under the belts, Holmes expects big things from juniors Logan Bannion, Caden Buss, and C.J. Donheffler, along with seniors Todd Ull and Luis Cota on both sides of the ball. Offensive line and defensive line wise is a very much a strong point for our team, Holmes said. We know we can count on those guys. They know they can put in the work and will bust their butt every day. That is what they're showing every day in the weight room. Coda, one of the team's main leaders this year, said that he expects the Wolverines to have more potential this season. It doesn't matter how old you are or how experienced you are, Coda said. As long as you are able to work hard, show commitment and dedication, anything can be done as long as you have those. Senior Drew Benson returns to the starting running back spot after leading the Wolverines a season ago with 245 rushing yards and 3 touchdowns on the ground. He was recently named to the Missouri River All-Conference first team after leading the West baseball team with a .340 average and a 23 RBI. As the starting back on a team with a run-heavy offensive tilt, Benson is going to see plenty of action this season. With the team now in its second season of the Holmes regime, Benson is confident that the Wolverines will start to see results on the field. Last year, coming with a new coach, it was kind of all shaken up a bit, Benson said. Now everyone has been in the weight room all summer, and everyone is on the same plan. Everything will come together a lot more than it did last year. The Wolverines will go into training camp with a 2-man battle at quarterback, as Jonathan Jones and Devin Fry fight for snaps. Fry got injured early last season after seeing some time at running back, but according to Holmes, he has looked strong since his return to the field. Jones is making the move from wide receiver, where he caught 6 passes for 57 yards in 2020. Jones is a very detailed young man. He is looking to play some quarterback, Holmes said. He is also going to challenge Devin Fry. Fry got hurt very early in the season last year. He came back with a vengeance and was very focused on being the quarterback. We definitely a better football team with either one of those guys at the helm. Whether he plays at quarterback or wide receiver this year, Jones isn't particularly interested in putting up big numbers. He'll be happy as long as his guys eat. If my running back is pushing the yards, if my receiver is getting the completions, and even if I have to and I'm getting the yards for it, Jones said, as long as we can all put that food on the table, it's going to be a good thing. While the offense will lean run, the Wolverines have plenty of options should they choose to take to the sky. Junior Mabier Acuan returns as wide receiver, as does senior Demarion Mothershead, who hauled in 9 passes for 125 yards in 2020. Master Brooks is another face that Holmes expects big things from this year. Brooks played defensive tackle last year, but Holmes said he has lost close to 40 pounds in the offseason and is set to be a big part of the offensive plan. He is very fast, very lean, and we are looking on him to be a playmaker as well, Holmes said. On defense, Holmes is eager to see players like junior linebacker Terrence Topetti, junior Antonio Medina, and senior cornerback Kenyon Brickman take to the field. We have some length at cornerback and free safety, so we match up pretty well lengthwise and heightwise, Holmes said. I cannot express just how excited I am to watch those boys play. Holmes knows that the outside expectations for his program are low. With a losing streak that stretches back nearly 3 years, the Wolverines admittedly have a lot to prove, both to themselves and to their football peers. But Holmes is setting some pretty high goals for his team in 2021 and is making sure that he stays focused not only on the X's and O's of the game, but also on the life lessons it teaches his players. At the end of the season, if we're looking at 5 to 6 good solid wins and some close games and that we can pull out, we're more than happy with that, Holmes said. Our main goal as a coaching staff is to make sure we're transitioning these kids into better people. Along with that, though, West football plans to start winning ball games. We're very excited about where we are at, Holmes said. We've still got a lot of work to do, but we're going to shock some people, I guarantee you. We'll now move to a story about a local restaurant. Daga's on Broadway wants to reinvent Midwestern comfort food cuisine. Dakota City. For more than 5 years, Daga's on Wheels has earned a reputation for its made-to-order wet burritos, super nachos, and its famous queso tacos, which consists of gooey mozzarella cheese stuck inside of 2 corn tortillas, along with plenty of onions and cilantro. With a few Weekender Siouxland Choice Awards under his belt, you would think that Degas on Wheels owner Tyson Sanchez would be able to rest on his laurels. Well, rest is not in the vocabulary of an ambitious entrepreneur like Sanchez, who knew Degas on Broadway has just opened for business at 100 North Main in Dakota City. And guess what? You won't find a taco, quesadilla, or a hot Cheeto nacho anywhere on the menu. That's because Sanchez wants Degas on Broadway to be where he can reimagine great American steakhouse favorites. Purchasing the building which formerly housed Hungry's, a popular steakhouse for more than two decades, is allowing him to do that. People loved Hungry's because they loved its steaks, chops, and chicken, Sanchez explained. When it closed, diners were disappointed and Dakota City lost a destination restaurant. When the location went up for sale, Sanchez bought it. In addition, he and his crew have spent nearly 10 months completely renovating the property. Gone are Hungry's imposing dark wood paneling. They've been replaced with a sleek aesthetic and comfortable seating. Wait, did we say that all of Hungry's dark wood is gone? Actually, a portion of it has been preserved for a private VIP table, honoring both the steakhouses and Dakota City's colorful past. We wanted the steakhouse to be a place where everyone would feel comfortable, Sanchez said. It didn't matter if a person brought his family or his wife on a special date. We would be able to accommodate. But Sanchez knew he needed help in crafting an entirely new menu. That's where veteran chef Clay Lilly came on board. Lilly previously worked as the executive chef at the Key Club and Clyde's. Before that, he was sous chef for the late Rick Bolot at the former Bev's on the River. I knew Clay had the talent and the imagination to create an awesome menu, Sanchez says. Sure enough, Degas on Broadway offers sirloin, New York strip, ribeye served every day. All are hand-cut, charbroiled to perfection, and topped with a house-made butter. On Fridays, Degas prime rib features a rib loin rubbed with a blend of herbs and spices before being slow roasted to a medium rare. I think it's cool when people ask us where we get our beef. We can just point down the street and say we get it at Tyson Fresh Meats, Sanchez noted with a chuckle. But Degas doesn't skimp on the sandwiches. They include a house burger, which contain a half-pound steak patty on a toasted brioche bun and served with pickles, lettuce, red onions, and a house aioli. Likewise, the New York steak sandwich is served with an open-faced New York strip steak that is seared, sliced, and placed on sourdough with creamy Swiss cheese, tomatoes, onions, and a horseradish sauce. Lilly called this cuisine comfort food with a twist. So are such appetizers as chislik, chicken fingers, and fried mushrooms, which are hand-breaded, fried crisp, and served with a side of Tabasco aioli. Sanchez admitted he and Lilly come from different culinary perspectives. Working on a food truck, I'm used to working fast, Sanchez says. Clay is teaching me that in a fine dining kitchen, things can go at a slower pace. One place where both Sanchez and Lilly need to take extra time is behind the bar. At the Key Club, I learned how to make alcoholic punches because I made the syrups that went in them, Lilly said, while pouring a summer breeze drink with berries, bourbon, lemonade, and lavender. Making a drink is more complex than making a cocktail. I prefer to spend my time in the kitchen. Soon, Degas will be opening a unique sports bar on the same premises, giving people an opportunity to have a meal in a steakhouse setting before watching football in a cozier atmosphere. Over the past 5 years, Sanchez has seen the food truck scene explode as mobile dining became more commonplace. I think within a short few years, you'll see more taco trucks than standalone Mexican restaurants, he explained. I started Degas on Wheels at the right time. Now Degas on Broadway represents my plan B. Don't worry, Sanchez already has a plan C and a plan D in the works. Right now, he just wanted to make sure Degas on Broadway is a success. While Dakota City is close to Sioux City, it still requires a drive, Sanchez says. I want Degas on Broadway to be that destination steakhouse, which will always be worth the drive. And it is located at 100 North Main Street in Dakota City, and the phone number is 402-241-5109. We now have a story from the Weekender, which is entitled Siouxland Strange. And gee, that was slick. A Sioux City man and woman were arrested after stealing from the cash register of a pool hall in the presence of onlookers. At around 12:19 a.m. on July 29th, 24-year-old Mark Anthony Queen and 27-year-old Cheyenne Linnea Schlottman, both of Sioux City, were at the Corner Pocket Pool Hall at 2425 Fifth Street. A witness advised that when the bartender stepped outside, Queen reached over the bar toward the cash register, according to criminal complaints. Schlottman, identified in a criminal complaint as Queen's boyfriend, acted as a lookout. The two then walked away. The witness advised the bartender that there was money laying on the floor, according to the complaints. Queen and Schlottman, who were identified by multiple witnesses, were located nearby. Queen was found with $950 cash, mostly in tens and twenties, stuffed into his pants. Schlottman, meanwhile, was discovered with a partial bottle of gabapentin, a drug normally used to control seizures or to treat certain nerve pains, that is sometimes taken recreational. She admitted that she did not have a prescription for the pills. Queen faces a charge of third-degree theft and was held in the Woodbury County Jail on $2,000 bond. Schlottman faces charges of third-degree theft and possession of prescription drugs and was held in the Woodbury County Jail on a $2,000 bond. We'll now move to Dear Abby. Dear Abby, my dearest friend passed away 5 years ago. He was a severe alcoholic and his death resulted from it. I was aware of how bad things had gotten, and I was trying to talk to him into getting help. I live across the country, but visited and spoke with him often. I was considering telling his parents how bad things were since they were mainly supporting him, but I was torn because he is an adult, and I didn't know if it would be appropriate. Well, while I was considering it, he passed away, and I haven't been able to get over the guilt. I feel like I should have done more. I have a strong urge to tell his parents I knew how he was doing and was contemplating telling them and how sorry I am that I didn't. Would it be selfish, like rubbing salt in their wounds just so I can find some kind of peace? I have been going back and forth with this since his death. I have such regret that I didn't do something more. I don't know if their forgiveness would help me or if I'd just be hurting them more. Your opinion on this would be helpful. Signed, full of regrets. And Abby responds, please forgive yourself and stop second-guessing. You are guilty of nothing more than being a caring friend. The deceased was responsible for his own alcohol-related death. If his parents were supporting him financially, they were already aware their son had a serious problem. Because after 5 years you cannot stop flogging yourself, you have two options. Discuss this with your religious advisor or ask your doctor or your insurance provider to refer you to some sessions with a licensed psychotherapist with whom you can work through this. In our next letter, Dear Abby, I have had a girlfriend for about 3 years, but I have recently begun to feel indifferent about our relationship. We have to travel to at least 45 minutes to see each other, and we don't always see each other on weekends. I have been trying to convince her to move into my townhome, but something new arises each time I bring it up. Recently, a younger woman, she's 21, I'm 32, showed an interest in me during one of my sports games. I've talked to her and won't let any relationship develop outside of being friends. She's religious and I'm not, and that's a deal breaker for me. I'm torn between continuing to try to build my current relationship, trying to pursue the new one, or taking a step back from relationships to focus on my personal goals. Any thoughts, Abby? Signed, Pondering in Pennsylvania. And Abby responds, it doesn't appear that you or your girlfriend of 3 years is really ready to take things to the next level. If you were, you would not be debating whether to trade her in for a newer model. As to the younger one, you just stated clearly that her religiosity is a deal breaker for you. Your third option makes the most sense. Concentrate on your personal goals for a while, and with time, your love life will work itself out. And that does it for today's reading of the Sioux City Journal for Tuesday, August 17th. I'm your reader, Dagna. You can access a recording of today's reading on our website, iowaradioreading.org, at any time. And thank you so much for listening. Thank you.
Some would call 88-year-old Sally Jackson a lucky senior.
A few years ago, a family member offered to move in and care for Sally so that she wouldn't have to leave the comfort of her own home.
But soon after, one of Sally's neighbors, Carol, paid a visit, unannounced.
Something wasn't quite right.
Sally's demeanor and physical appearance had changed.
Luckily, Carol was aware of warning signs that might signal elder abuse.
Such as bruises, poor hygiene,
isolation, depression,
appearing withdrawn or unusually quiet, as if to hide something.
When victimized, elderly people often feel ashamed, confused.
But an alert neighbor helped Sally.
Not all abused seniors are as lucky as Sally Jackson.
McGruff the Crime Dog here. The National Crime Prevention Council wants to help you and your loved ones prevent elder abuse. Know what to look for. Know how to report it to local law enforcement agencies.
To learn more, go to ncpc.org/seniors. That's ncpc.org/seniors. A message from the National Crime Prevention Council and the U.S. Department of Justice.